are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 25th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, illegal. How America's lawless immigration regime threatens all of us. Elizabeth Cohen will be on the program. Meanwhile, Bloomberg throws the gold-plated kitchen sink at Bernie Sanders after Sanders' latest polls show he is expanding his national lead. He's taken the lead with African Americans from Joe Biden. Meanwhile, Donald Trump focuses on the stock market and ignores the coronavirus as the production and shipment of 150 different prescription drugs are now in jeopardy. Meanwhile, Trump is in India as attacks on Muslims increase. And Mitch McConnell furthers the assault on a woman's right to choose and her bodily sovereignty. Meanwhile, the FBI is investigating a massive Border Patrol union funds embezzlement case. And again, once again, calls for Clarence Thomas to recuse himself because of the work of his wife, Ginny. Harvey Weinstein, found guilty of rape, awaits sentencing. And the UC Santa Cruz Strikers are to be fired from their teaching assistant positions. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Just a programming note for you. Today is Tuesday, February 25th at 8 p.m. or so, maybe 7:30. We will be starting our coverage of tonight's debate. There is a debate tonight in South Carolina, if you were not aware of that, or if you were unaware, I should say. And that debate promises to be a rather, I think, explosive one. I think it's safe to anticipate there are going to be attacks from Michael Bloomberg on Bernie Sanders. I think it's fair to anticipate there will be attacks on Michael Bloomberg from Elizabeth Warren and just about everybody else. I believe it is fair to assume that Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg will be maybe coming to actual fisticuffs.
Oh, and my God. I cannot wait to see that.
Tom Steyer is in the race. And Joe Biden is scheduled to be there, but one never knows. One can get lost on the way to the debates. And we will. We actually have a programmatic announcement today to make about Joe Biden, but we will hold off on that. We have one video to play, but we're entering into the realm where we're not going to play certain videos about Joe Biden.
Or sound drops.
Some sound drops we're going to keep.
Right. But some we're going
to retire. But some we're not. We're going to retire.
In interest of
honestly, encouraging him to retire as well.
Honestly, it's just.
Yeah. It's at one point. But who knows? I mean, the reality is Joe Biden could win tonight. Saturday in South Carolina. So we'll see.
He's so much more charming when you depict him as like this Mr. Magoo-like character.
Especially like on the pages of The Onion.
Yes. And if he was just not sort of like if there wasn't the potential that he could actually win the nomination and all of our fates would be in his hands. That's what would be, that's the most concerning thing. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a while since we've checked in with the pontiff. Of course, I'm speaking of Ben Shapiro. He is the self-anointed Pope of the Jews. He is the one who gets to determine who is a Jew and who is not a Jew. And let's weigh in today to see who Ben Shapiro has decided by his great grace, his holy grace. Who shall be a Jew and who shall not be a Jew?
You're deeply concerned about anti-Semitism, but you don't care about the fact that Bernie Sanders is, he campaigns with open anti-Semites. That Bernie Sanders is the Jeremy Corbyn of the United States. He spends all his time hanging out with people who despise Jews. And
pause it for 1 second. Now, for the analogy to be correct, aside from all the other lies that he's telling, Jeremy Corbyn would also have to be Jewish. Right? That's the breakdown in the analogy.
Well, Bernie's not really Jewish, though.
Well, we got to get there. But, I mean, even nominally, Jeremy Corbyn does not even claim to be Jewish. In fact, he doesn't even claim that his family members, distant family members, were killed by Hitler for being Jewish. That's where the analogy breaks down at the beginning.
And want to see the Jewish state destroyed. Hey, the Bernie Sanders over the weekend suggested, he's never spoken at an AIPAC policy conference, by the way, at an American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference. He's never spoken at one, not for years, ever. Right now, when he's a presidential candidate in 2016, never. Okay, he put out a statement suggesting that he would not speak at AIPAC, said Bernie Sanders, who, again, this when people talk about his Jewish roots, he's so Jewish. In terms of his actual practice, in terms of how much he cares about Judaism, not his ethnic Judaism. Ethnic Judaism is ethnic Judaism. It's just an ethnicity. But in terms of his actual practical Judaism and how much he cares about Judaism, dude's as Jewish as a ham sandwich. He's Jewish like Karl Marx was Jewish. Okay, Bernie Sanders tweets out, the Israeli people have a right to live in peace and security. So do the Palestinian people. First of all, I've not seen one shred of evidence that Bernie actually believes that Jewish people in Israel have a right to live in peace and security, since he has backed every single deal that would do damage to the safety and security of the people of Israel and supports giving...
Pause it for 1 second. Now, Ben surely knows this because he is the Pope of the Jews, but not every Israeli Jew would constitute a Jew in Ben Shapiro's mind. I've got some, I imagine that the Pope of the Jews has been to Israel, but surely his pontiff, his grace, must be aware that there are many Jews in Israel who do not practice Judaism whatsoever.
Yeah, there's some real bad ones in Tel Aviv.
I mean, they're just culturally Jewish, according to the Pope of the Jews, Ben Shapiro.
Have a right to live in peace and security, since he has backed every single deal that would do damage to the safety and security of the people of Israel and supports giving foreign aid to Hamas. He said, I remain concerned about the platform AIPAC provides for leaders who express bigotry and oppose basic Palestinian rights. For that reason, I will not attend that conference. As president, I will support the rights of both Israelis and Palestinians and do everything possible to bring peace and security to the region. Bullcrap. Hey, bullcrap. AIPAC is the most milquetoast organization in Israel affairs. Like, the most milquetoast. They have everybody. Democrats, Republicans, moderates, like, they have everybody speaks to AIPAC. Okay, but Bernie is saying that AIPAC is too much for him. As we'll see, Bernie is fine with anti-Semites in his own campaign. So spare me your crocodile tears over anti-Semitism, all you ridiculous leftists who don't give a damn when Jews are under rocket fire in Israel and don't give a damn when Jews are being beaten on the streets of Williamsburg. Now you're coming out of the woodwork to inform me that Chris Matthews is an anti-Semite because he made an oblique statement about people who aren't willing to accept reality in history. People are ridiculous. You're ridiculous. You don't give a crap about anti-Semitism. If you did, you wouldn't be nominating a guy who is more than happy to hobnob with anti-Semites. Again, the man's as Jewish as Karl Marx was Jewish.
Aside from the irony of all the people that Ben Shapiro has platformed in his day and has supported, who have platformed other people who have a far more militant claim. Now, of course, the Pope, Ben Shapiro, does not believe that Bernie Sanders qualifies as Jewish because the Pope, Ben Shapiro. Now, let me ask you this. I know everybody says that he wears a kippah, But doesn't also the Pope also wear what looks like a kippah? Because I wonder if Ben Shapiro, when he's not out in public, wears the big Pope hat. Now,
so I just tried to look up to see if, you know, calling people Jews in name only was one of the things he apologized and is, so here's a giant list of all the dumb stuff I've ever said. Don't worry, I'll keep updating it thing. But it's behind a paywall now.
Ah!
That's smart.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, folks, incidentally, that reminds me, I have written a list of some of my largest apologies for a lot of things that you're not aware.
Some of the worst stuff you've done.
Some of the worst things I've done, things that I have never, ever even acknowledged happened in public. And that's available to you as a member of the Majority Report. Now, of course, you got to come in as a Sam Cedar member. That is $1,000 a month. But again, that allows you to see the all of the horrible things that I've done and my apologies for them. And of course, we only take that in year-long installments. So you could sign up at jointhemajorityreport.com. And I've just been informed that the Pope Yarmulke is called a zucchetto. So, I mean, it's not clear to me if what Shapiro is wearing is a kippah or a yarmulke, or in fact, a zucchetto.
I'm learning a lot.
He's the Pope. He gets to decide who a Jew is and who a Jew is not.
Yep, and all the Jews listen to him.
Now,
that's just what we're like.
Here's the thing. Ben Shapiro practices rabbinic Judaism. And everyone knows that rabbinic Judaism is less than 2,100 years old. I practice the only true Judaism, which is the one of the temple, where priests ruled the day, Hebrew priests, and we, because I say we, because I am a real Jew, and Ben Shapiro is a pretender. And the high priests would accept all sorts of gifts and sacrifices. So you could bring me a goat or you could bring me money. And it wasn't until Ben Shapiro's friend Jesus came in and threw the money changers aside. So it is so ironic to me that the Pope, Ben Shapiro, pretends that he knows what Jews are. But I tell you right now, I am the one who decides who a real Jew is. And Ben Shapiro is no real Jew. In fact, this whole APEC conspiracy is known as a beard. It's a beard to hide the fact that he's not a real Jew. And I also noticed he shaves. He shaves. He shaves in the 5 points. It's a real problem. It's a real problem.
I thought you were going to say you practice the immortal science of Marxist-Leninism.
No, that is not true either. I just am full on temple-based Hebrewism. So there you go. Folks, oh, we've talked about Embark many times. Where did I get Kelly? Where's Kelly's thing? I thought I printed that out. I did, but I think Brendan threw it out. So Embark is a it is a breed and health test. Basically tells you your dog's DNA. I got it. I'm all right. And it is the key to unlocking what your dog's unique breed mix are, what their health situation is from a genetic standpoint. And there's a lot of benefits to this. Like, it wasn't until we started running ads for Embark that I really fully appreciated this this service. So we had Kelly try it for Edie, which is her dog, old, not old Kelly, but formerly of the show Kelly, formerly in studio Kelly. And this is what she told me. I received Edie's results from Embark. There's so much information about her. She tested clear for all 171 genetic health conditions they screened for. And she's not a carrier at risk for any of the genetic diseases they test for as well. Now, this apparently is hugely important because there are ways in which you can feed your dog. There are medications you can give your dog if you find out that they are predisposed. And apparently this happens depending on, you know, if they've been bred or whatever it is for certain diseases. And from with that type of genetic information, you can figure out what kind of food is going to keep them as healthy as possible. People love their dogs. I got an email, I think I mentioned this last time, from a listener in England who was talking about his brother's relationship to their dog and that his brother had some issues in terms of like socialization. And the dog has just been amazing in terms of getting this kid to be able to sort of like have less social anxiety. And so the dog's health becomes huge. And just knowing stuff about the dog has been a huge sort of boon for not only his brother, but the whole family. Kelly went on to say there's also a full clinical trait report, which is great news. Most importantly, I can provide the report to her vet, which will provide so much information, help with Edie's health as she grows up. The Embark Dog DNA Test, it's the most comprehensive kit on the market. It looks at over 250 breeds, looks at 170 genetic health conditions. Somebody last time, I think we read this ad, Nomi was on the show. She had mentioned something about it in terms of knowing its relatives. And we thought like, oh, you don't know that. And then somebody tweeted at us with like a whole breakdown of the dog's relatives.
Long lost relative?
I mean, I would imagine for a dog, they're all long lost for the most part. Embark is the only research grade dog DNA test kit on the market. Scientists look at 200,000 genetic markers and they make scientific discoveries that help all dogs have longer, healthier lives. And they're accurate down to a 5% breed component. Embark has stellar customer service and vets and veterinary geneticists on staff to talk you through your results. Right now, Embark has an exclusive offer you can't get anywhere else. Go to EmbarkVet.com now. Use the promo code MAJORITY. Save 15% off your dog DNA test kit. Visit EmbarkVet.com. Use promo code MAJORITY to save. Check it out, folks. I don't need to tell you how much you love your dog. I hope not. That would be weird.
I'm a little mad they don't have one for cats.
Yeah, why don't they have it? Do they not?
I just got another cat, actually. I would be intrigued by something like that.
Yeah. I don't know. It seems like dogs have more health problems than cats. Is that true? Because I don't think cats are cats bred in the same way.
Seems like it. No, I mean, there are like lots of fancy breeds of cats, but I guess most cats people have are just like regular ass cats.
All right. Well, folks, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Elizabeth Cohen about her book, Illegal, How America's Lawless Immigration Regime Threatens Us All. We'll be right back after this.
Drunk on a wagon to Mexico. Oh, yeah, what a champ, man. My head got a bump when I hit it on the
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at Syracuse University, Elizabeth F. Cohen, author of Illegal, How America's Lawless Immigration Regime Threatens Us All. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, I want to start, and what you've given us is a history of sorts of our immigration policy, in many respects, our lack of immigration policy, and really until the present day. I'm not sure what that was, but let's start with the 1924. It's the National Origins Act, right? The Johnson Reed Act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This was our country's first attempt at comprehensive immigration reform, and it was comprehensively restrictionist based on race. So Congress enacted quotas for almost all countries sending immigrants to the United States at the time. Those were European countries. It was based on a lot of pretty shoddy race science about who would make a good citizen, who was and was not white. At the time, most European countries were not considered white ethnicities in the U.S., and it effectively ended most immigration to the U.S. in the 1950s.
What was the impetus, A, of that act? I mean, just broadly speaking from a political standpoint. Prior to that, what was the immigration situation? Because I think I've spoken to people who suggested that the influx of immigration prior to that time was in part a function of a desire to essentially squeeze out recently freed slaves from much of the workforce. We've lost her. Yeah, hold on for one second. We'll go to the break. Sorry. Hi, sorry about that. I think we lost you for a moment. So you had just told us essentially the concept behind the National Origins Act. My question to you was two-part. One was, what was the political environment that that spurred that legislation, A, and B, that wave of immigration I have read that preceded the 1924 Act, maybe in the decades prior to that, was in part a function of a desire to bring in more people, white people, or presumably European people, I guess, who maybe were not necessarily considered white, as a way of squeezing out recently freed slaves and limiting their opportunities, particularly in the cities. If you know anything about the latter, please tell me. And if you, sir, obviously about the former, what the political context for that legislation was.
Yeah, I mean, the political context really, it's an outgrowth of very early 20th century race science and early pushes at sociobiology. I'm sorry to say that I'm a social scientist, and these are early social scientists doing what they think is social science, looking at craniometry and skull size and looking for who they judge will be good citizens. And unsurprisingly, they find that lots and lots of people who are not considered white at the time are unlikely to make good citizens based on their measurements. And then something in 1911, the Dillingham Report, commissioned by Congress, like turns this into a massive study of immigrants and immigrant neighborhoods. finding that recent immigrants from south and Eastern Europe, so Italy, Sicily, Hungary, Russia, Poland, and also Irish immigrants, that they just like fail in every way to demonstrate that they're assimilating, that they're good workers, all these things. It's pretty racialized, but I think the thing that's very hard for people in 2020 to wrap their heads around is that none of these people were considered white at the time. So to kind of hear the narrative that there was an attempt to bring white people from Europe into the country to make things harder for native-born African-American workers is a little difficult to reconcile with the very clear language you hear both in that report and then from like Wilson and others, that they did not consider the people coming from Europe at the time to be white, or that they would become white, or that they could assimilate. So there is a lot of racism, and certainly, you know, in the labor market, there were attempts to squeeze the labor market and keep wages down on lots of fronts. But the reason for shutting the doors was because the people who were coming in were upsetting the genetic mix of the country, according to some of these folks writing the legislation.
And so, what was the impact of that you know, shutting the door to Europe?
Sure, it's a pretty dramatic, immediate drop in immigration because the quotas limited the opportunity for almost anybody from a country that was sending that where people wanted to come from almost to zero. So, you know, I found it interesting in doing the research from this book to look at the quota, country by country quotas, and then match them up to what people were saying. And like even the Scandinavian countries that Trump talks about as kind of model white potential immigrants, Norway and Sweden, they were, by many of the people writing this bill, not considered eligible, like not white enough. So immigration plummets throughout the 20s. One notable thing about the bill is that they omitted any reference or restriction on immigration within the Americas. So it's possible still to come from Mexico. And once there's essentially a halt on labor coming from Europe, Mexican immigration starts. There was already immigration coming in from Mexico, but it goes up. So that's one of the first consequences. Second, we invent a federal border patrol, and it's tiny, but that's where that gets going. It's part of the 1924 Act because you had to actually police the border once you had one. And then the beginnings of a rudimentary documentation system, because we hadn't really been doing much documentation before that. So all of the kind of infrastructure that we're really familiar with now, it didn't exist at the time on the federal level. So enforcement had to be invented during that decade.
And
but
so,
the most important thing is immigration just like stops from Europe. It just grinds to a halt.
And so what changes going forward in terms of, you know, what are the implications? I mean, you say there's a rise in immigration from Latin America, from Central America. What else happens, and does that take us all the way up to the Hart-Celler Act, or is there any dramatic change in between the 24 essentially and 65?
Yeah, I think part of the story there is building enforcement, building Border Patrol. You know, it's really interesting to me that early on, that Mexico is very eager to cooperate with U.S. enforcement, particularly Border Patrol, because they're not happy about the fact that so many highly skilled farm workers and other people are leaving the country. And like they're pretty interested in us enforcing some kinds of rules about who can cross over the border. That's less true for people in border communities who find it incredibly disruptive to have people essentially sent from Washington telling them what to do. And like they didn't like that they were enforcing prohibition and stuff like that. You get penalties for the first time for being unauthorized in the country in 1929. We never had federal penalties for being unauthorized prior to that. So I talk about that. But, like, it's a buildup of enforcement and of a particular type of enforcement culture that that carves out a lot of exceptions that aren't available to other law enforcement agencies. Like, really early on, just establishing themselves as very, very heavily empowered in ways that we can now see coming to fruition.
Let's talk about some of that, those early powers, and then we can talk in a bit. We'll circle back around to talk about the you know, how those... what I would constitute, I mean, to me, constitute abuses, but in some ways they're sort of like, you know, a built-in structural, structurally. How are they able to do that? How is it that, you know, they have this, first tell us how they exceed the authority of other police agencies, and then explain how it is they get away with it.
Yeah. So in the book, I tell a two-track story, and the two tracks are kind of first starting with a culture, I call it like a culture of impunity, where their border patrol, which is what it's called at the outset, is like hard to staff. It attracts a lot of people with criminal records, people who aren't particularly, they can't pass their civil service exam, and like border patrol essentially gets permission to just hire people who don't pass because they can't staff themselves without doing that. And then, so there's like this early agency culture of breaking rules and getting away with it. And then at a certain point, they also start to, the agency itself starts to say, like, we can't operate in the way that other law enforcement operates. We need exemptions and exceptions. And so they start asking for permission to do things like warrantless searches and seizures, both at the border, so at checkpoints, and then on the interior. And they start out with that in 1946, and then kind of try and get that institutionalized so that we get to a point now where we have two zones in that Customs and Border Protection operate in. One is better known, it's the 100-mile zone. So 100 miles from any point on the U.S. border into the interior, 100 miles, is their jurisdiction. And there are essentially interpretations of the Fourth Amendment, which is supposed to protect us from unreasonable search and seizures, unlawful search and seizures, that are interpreted differently for them so that they can enter our cars and stop us in ways that other law enforcement couldn't. Like, essentially, they can profile, so they can stop people. The court has said stop people, like, for looking the wrong way. So the original decision says for looking Mexican or having a haircut of the sort that a Mexican person would have. So, you know, other law enforcement can't do things like that. They're not permitted. They might be doing it, but Customs and Border Protection can. And then you see, you know, all the way up until today, where we're seeing court decisions relevant to this, that they also do things that really should be illegal and are never punished for it. So their rates of violent interactions, using their weapons, and in some cases fatally, you know, those are extraordinarily high.
They're in fact, I mean, just today. And I'm not even sure if you're aware of this, because I think it may have just broke. I'm not sure. Hernandez versus Mesa.
Yep.
Are you familiar with that? Can you tell us tell us what the issue was there? And the court has ruled essentially that the U.S. Border Patrol agent implicated in this case is really not accountable at all for what they did.
Not accountable.
Will you tell us impunity. What it was?
So it's certainly not the first time something like this has happened, but a boy was playing at the border, and for people who haven't been to the border, haven't read about the border, haven't seen pictures of it, it's not like a line that you hop over. It's a zone, and there's different layers of fencing in various parts, and he had kind of started playing within the layer of the fence that put him over by U.S. American agents, and a Border Patrol agent shot and killed him. And the court's ruling today was about the question of whether the family can sue the agent, and the court said no. And so, you know, that really, I think to most of us, constitutes total impunity when the family cannot seek any kind of satisfaction or redress for their child being shot.
Right. And to be clear here, this is not, they're not a dude. I just want everybody to understand what the question is here. They're not adjudicating whether the guard had any guilt or, had done it with any intent. They're not making any judgment on that. They're just questioning whether the guard can actually be charged with anything or be held to account or can even go to court to have that question addressed.
Yeah, they're saying that essentially the family cannot sue in U.S. court. So they have no opportunity to seek any kind of justice.
And
it doesn't, there's question in this case about whether the boy had thrown a rock. But basically, as I understand it, it just came down, so I haven't read the whole thing yet. They're saying it doesn't even matter whether, even if there had been, it's contested whether anything had happened at all, but,
it
doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't even matter. Like the facts in this case on some level don't even matter because they can't be, the court is saying that they're so above the law that they can't even be, this question can't even be adjudicated. All right. Well, so
yeah.
We got a little ahead of ourselves, obviously, because we're present day. But let's talk about the Hart-Celler Act. This is really in 1965. You write the first, sort of recontemplation from the National Origins Act as to how we treat immigration.
Yeah. So there's kind of two sides to Hart-Celler. The side that you hear most often is that this is like the opening up of immigration to the United States because, indeed, we do completely eliminate racial and national origin quotas. So the act reorganizes and basically says we're going to let people in on the basis of skills, family reunification, and then refuge, because at the time we didn't really have a separate refugee program. So in one sense, it's really turning things around for the United States, opening up to immigration and opening up to immigration from everywhere in the world. And it had not been possible to legally immigrate from large portions of the world ever in United States history. So this is a big change, going to allow immigration from African countries, from lots of Asian countries, and it does change the demographics of the United States. The underneath story is, of course, of what some of the authors wanted. And it's interesting because, underneath it, it's not a story about openness to racial change. It's a story about the fact that European immigrants were now considered white. And some of the authors of the legislation were debating about how to stabilize the population in the United States and keep it white. And their theory was that family reunification, which is now the bane of the existence of people like Stephen Miller, they call it chain migration, family reunification was going to keep this country European origin white because people would sponsor their family members from Germany and Ireland, which had been kind of incorporated into whiteness by that time, and that would kind of stabilize demographically the United States. And some of their quotes are extremely openly racist about immigration from countries that turned out to actually be sources of immigration for the United States. What you get almost immediately are lots and lots of people coming from, you get refugees coming from Southeast Asia, you get a large population of Vietnamese refugees. Just really demographically very different set of immigrants after 1965. So they were trying to keep the population white, but as often happens when Congress tries to engineer the racial balance of the population, it completely backfires and we get the exact opposite of what they were trying to do.
Well, now why didn't they simply say, we're just going to open up immigration, but just to Europe?
I think there was a sense that it was unseemly and that what you wanted to do was do that in a facially neutral way without seeming to discriminate. And, that's something that you see different versions of, especially during the Cold War, which, kind of attempt to not look like there's racism happening when there's racism happening.
Right.
It's 1965. It's right in the middle of of a lot of civil rights reforms, and I think there's a sense that one should not, on the face of things, be saying we don't want immigrants, you know, from country X or country Y. But definitely that was the sentiment of some of the authors of the legislation.
Well, certainly Stephen Miller and Donald Trump have learned that lesson on some level, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how, not so much with the facial neutrality. They're pretty open with it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, is that they're aiming for a wider immigrant population, and they're full on going for it, right? I mean, isn't in part like what the, you know, the Muslim ban was ultimately about in some respects? They've expanded it and they said, oh, we can have our cake and eat it too. We can, as long as we expand to just people who are not white, then we're not on the line for being anti-Muslim.
Yeah. I mean, there's some question in my mind about whether Stephen Miller is okay with any immigrant at all. But I think for most of the people to whom they're trying to appeal, this is a coming out party for white nationalists who have, you know, been operating under kind of undercover for a really long time. Which, you know, one of the other stories I tell in the book is how influential people who wanted, you know, a white United States, a white nation, how influential they were in policymaking. 1965 is one example, but, you know, you see a lot of interest group activity trying to put a pretty nice, shiny, scientific face on white nationalism, starting especially in the 90s. You see it earlier, but really ramps up in the 90s, particularly after the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993.
Well, let's move up in terms of time. Now, you also write about family reunification, that it's basically an outsourcing. I mean, part of this is premised on the idea that immigration is good. And maybe on some level we need to sort of like, you know, restate that case for us. Why don't we do that? Because on some level, like, you know, like I say, Stephen Miller and Donald Trump are acting fairly rationally based upon their desired outcomes here. At the very least, they have internalized the lesson of like, you know, maybe it's better for us not to pretend so much that we aren't racist, so that we can make sure that we get a racist outcome.
Yeah.
But make the case for immigration, or, you know, at the very, I mean, the positive case for immigration.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's lots and lots of good arguments we can make about free movement and human rights. In the case of the United States, we have practical interests at stake, and I don't think that we are entitled to the rest of the world meeting our practical needs, but it is the case that if we were to have fairly open immigration, we'd be much better off than we are with closed immigration. So there's a couple of different ways you can get at this argument. One of the ways I like to remind my students in class, the origins of borders were not really just to keep kind of people, ordinary people out. They were often to keep ordinary people in, because a population is one of the most important resources the country has. In the United States, our native-born population does not replace itself. There's like a, you know, number of births, I think like 2.1, 2.3 births per native-born woman to be at replacement level. We haven't met that standard for a long time, but we have managed to not shrink and age as a population in the way that countries in Europe, Italy or Japan also have, because we have had immigration into the country. So just in terms of having a labor force, having people who are both working and paying taxes, it's really important for the United States to keep its borders fairly open. We rely on that. It's also the case that there's a, you know, really big economic advantages, not just to having immigrants in the country, but in particular to having legal immigrants, so people with legal status, and people who become citizens, but particularly being legal, having authorization, because although undocumented immigrants, 40% of undocumented immigrants pay not, you know, state and federal taxes as well as, you know, other like taxes on things that they purchase and real estate. But once you bump people all into legal status, they get paid better because they can't be exploited
right.
the same way, and then they pay more taxes. So there are those kinds of advantages that are really significant. You mentioned family reunification as an outsourcing, and like, you know, Republicans right now just love to hate on family reunification because they are pursuing openly racist policies. But in fact, you know, if we were to move, let's say, not to closing our borders, but to a points-based system, we're moving towards something that's similar to what Canada does. And Canada does not in any way only rely on a points-based system. So they have a very robust refuge program. But in Canada, they budget a lot of money that we don't budget for immigrant integration. So family reunification is a very, like, I say outsourced, it's a very low-cost way to get the work done that needs to be done when people come into the country from places and don't speak the language, don't know how to navigate the bus system, things like that.
And we should be clear, the idea is that family reunification obligates the family, essentially, to take care of this person who's coming in the event that they don't have resources or whatnot. And so that's where we're talking about, you know, outsourcing this or privatizing the costs, although the benefits of this immigrant are socialized insofar as that they're ultimately going to pay taxes.
Yeah. So if you're undocumented, it's very likely that you're paying taxes, but you can't take advantage of any of the things you pay taxes for because you're legally prevented from accessing those programs. So if you're undocumented, you'll be paying into Social Security if you're paying your taxes, which, like I said, 40% are. And you'll never, even if you were regularized, the money that you pay in while you're undocumented, you never see it. So we're, like, kind of cheating as U.S. citizens. We're taking that and not giving anything back. But if you're documented, then you're paying in even more, most likely, and your family is responsible for making sure that they can vouch for the fact that you will be supported.
Is that where? And again, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but the public charge law comes in to basically say, okay, yes, we once we try and quash family reunification, and we no longer have, you know, essentially representatives or families of people in this country who are agreeing to take care of the immigrants, we will then quash the public charge or use the public charge as a way of making sure that, okay, because we can't rely on families now to take care of our immigrants, we're only going to have rich people come in.
So, sort of. I mean, we don't have to get rid of family reunification for, and public charge went into effect yesterday. The public charge rule, we've yet to see really like how it's going to be used, but in its most restrictionist form, it would end almost all legal immigration to the United States because the formula for determining not whether someone has been a public charge. That's not what the formula is. The formula is for determining in the future would people be likely to become a public charge. And it is a really tough bar to meet, and there's lots of discretion involved, which is part of why people are worried that it'll just end legal immigration. But yeah, you're going to have to be able to prove that you will not in any way in the future become eligible for publicly supported programs. The thing is, like, it's a sensationalist thing in the sense that most of the programs that people like to talk about immigrants using, immigrants are not eligible to use and don't use.
Right.
And when you get to the, you know, point of being undocumented, of course, people are not just afraid to use programs like they're ineligible for. They're afraid to, like, take their kids for stuff because they're afraid that that will expose their own status, even if their kids are eligible. So it's going to lead to bad health outcomes, bad educational outcomes, and bad demographic outcomes, I think.
Okay, so getting back to the history, I guess, we go after the Hart-Celler Act. In the 1980s, do we really see any change in sort of the statutory framework of immigration. I mean, I know that we have Reagan has a, you know, significant amnesty during that time.
Yeah.
Are there any sort of like structural changes?
The amnesty is significant because it regularizes, allows a pathway to citizenship for a bunch of legal short-term workers, people who've been here on short-term visas, and then also allows a bunch of undocumented workers who'd been continuously present in the United States since 1982 to regularize, and that's a big deal. That also is the last point at which we update something that had been like a very, very low-key regularization program I talk about in the book since 1929 called Registry. Just said, like, if you got here by a certain date and you've been in the country being a citizenly person, you become eligible. So that's like the – and then, of course, that's the first moment at which there are employer sanctions for employing undocumented workers. It had not been – there had been no penalty before that for employers who were employing undocumented workers. There's not a lot of muscle. Like, Congress doesn't put a lot of money into enforcement, but you do start to see a real enforcement mentality surfacing in the 1980s, in some part connected to the war on drugs, which was Reagan's less amnesty-oriented program, and then in part because there was, like, a panic being fomented about undocumented immigrants.
Let's jump to the Clinton administration and the story of MS-13 in particular. But if there's anything else there that you think we should highlight, MS-13 obviously played a big part in the 2016 election, at least in the context of Donald Trump's rhetoric. What was the dynamic there with MS-13?
So MS-13 is a U.S. origin gang that is kind of like a lightning rod for both, I mean, in for nativists, to be sure. But you'd seen a lot of people who'd been incarcerated as we started to engage in mass incarceration. Some folks who'd been incarcerated in the United States, then deported. That really fed into the development of some pretty devastating gangs in Central America that then found their way back into the United States. And so you start to see that emerging a little bit as an issue. Clinton, I think, most important thing to identify about Clinton is what happened in 1996. And in 1996, that's when you really see it's the moment in which mass incarceration and mass deportation of immigrants in the United States, both documented and undocumented, that becomes possible in a way it had never been possible before. We were incarcerating some people starting in the early 80s, but like what happens in 1996, two bills pass, same year that we pass TANF and get rid of welfare, and what happens is that a kind of special category of something called an aggravated felony. So an ordinary felony is 5-year serious offense, usually a violent crime, something quite serious. 1996, just for immigrants, really, just for non-citizens, this aggravated felony, which only has a 1-year sentence, comes into existence. And we make detention mandatory for anybody who's committed an aggravated felony. But the crimes, in some cases, are so minor, like sometimes people aren't even serving any time for the actual crime, but they have to be detained. And then, so that's this ADEPA bill. Then we also get the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act that just adds a ton of tiny crimes to that. These would be misdemeanors for citizens, like forgery, document fraud, bribery, you know, skipping bail, things like that. But now they're subject to mandatory detention. They end up in deportation proceedings. for misdemeanors, and they really also suffer a real reduction in the rights that they have to try and, like, get due process. So the deportation machine, I think many people would date it to 1996 in Congress under Clinton.
And what was that a response to? I mean, from politically, because I'm trying to remember in 96, you know, sort of the context in which that would come about. Was that just simply, you know, it's not terribly contested, and so, you know, people can get away with it? Or is it a function of you know, NAFTA, or is it what's going on there?
I mean, so Clinton, you know, had already been going after tougher enforcement on immigration a little bit earlier. So, like, policing some of the heavily crossed areas that were safe crossings to try and force people into the desert. You know, that had happened a few years earlier. I think there was a real turning point in the early 90s where there's some pretty active, openly white nationalist organizations, a bunch of which were headed by this guy, John Tanton, who just died last year, had been funded by Mellon Scaife, and who were actively seeking to kind of change the laws to reflect a more closed immigration policy and white nationalist agenda. And they motivated people first using 1993, but then you may remember that before we knew who had committed the 1995 terrorist attack in Oklahoma City, a lot of people tried to pin it on Islamic extremists. It was two white nationalists, in fact, who did it.
Right.
But it kind of, like, got people in this mindset of skepticism about immigration and immigrants that policy entrepreneurs were able to exploit.
And I guess, too, there was the rise of Pat Buchanan in the early 90s. And even on some level, you know, Ross Perot's run may have sort of had some of those undertones a little bit.
This is a time of, like, you know, we're still in the war on drugs. There's this, you know, it wasn't as if mass incarceration of citizens was unpopular.
Right.
We were talking about super predators, and, like, Clinton was friendly to that way of thinking about law and law and order. And it's just incredibly consequential and expensive in all kinds of ways.
All right. Well, when you start to talk about reforms in the book, one of the things you do is you talk about some of those 1996 laws. But let's start with the registry, which you had mentioned earlier. You can go really in any order you want in terms of when we talk about the reforms that you're espousing. And I'm curious as to also the genesis of some of these ideas of your reforms.
The genesis is just like watching a country that has an image of itself as one thing behave like the totally opposite thing for a very long time. I've been watching and just kind of wondering why we have such a self-destructive and other destructive policy. But so I think to understand the reforms I'm suggesting, the one thing we haven't talked about yet is what happens in 2003. And so after the September 11th attacks in 2001,
right,
Congress freaks out and wants to reorganize the federal government. It's a huge reorganization undertaken really hastily that ends up creating the Department of Homeland Security. So they start on
and everything
right
gets dumped into the Department of Homeland Security, like everything.
It's just one of the biggest reorganizations of the federal government that's ever happened in the United States, and it's done in a rush, really slipshod. Bush didn't actually want DHS to be elevated to cabinet level. He opposed that. He only went along with it when it was presented to him as, like, this is going to happen. It passed by, I think, one vote. It's not popular. But it takes what had been Immigration and Naturalization Services, the INS, which had existed since 1932, breaks it up into several different agencies and reorganizes them under Homeland Security, ostensibly because we faced national security threats that were related to immigration. That turns out to be such a dishonesty, such an untruth, that if you look at the budget, you can see over time the budget going immediately, pretty quickly, from national security stuff to enforcement and removals. Like, it just was a deportation machine pretty shortly after it was created. But the ostensible, the line we were told was that somehow the southern border was responsible for security threats to the United States. It's never happened. There's not anything being shut down there that could have happened but didn't happen.
But people have found prayer rugs in the desert. Isn't that true? I'm being facetious. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. I get a little bit dry at times. No, I still feel like that is, I don't know if they're still running that same story every 3 weeks on Breitbart, but that was the, some soccer jersey.
You're made of stronger stuff than I am, if you can read.
Well,
I actually went through some of the, John Tanton's organizations are, FAIR, CIS, and Numbers USA. First two have been classified by Southern Poverty Law Center as hate groups. And I looked at their data and their attempts to show that there are security threats at the southern border, and they can't. They just have nothing.
I mean, the most recent version was in the run up to 2018 when Mike Pence was out there saying that we've caught, 70 terrorists in the caravan or wherever it was he was saying at one point.
Yeah, look to see what they can pursue. There's just zero evidence. But we have these agencies since 2003, and they're immense. So we're giving just those agencies, just Customs and Border Protection and ICE, over $20 billion a year. And, that doesn't even count the fact that they tend to overspend their budgets. That doesn't count the money that they're taking away from sometimes from Pentagon spending, from other cabinet level agencies. And like we've already said, to do what? Mostly to perpetuate this culture of impunity. But I take readers through that story because it's really important to see how hasty, how poorly thought out, and how costly those changes that were really reactionary, emotional reactions to September 11th, how they've been. And I say three things I think, we really need to do. We need to create a way in the United States for people who have been here for a long time without authorization but have been citizenly, to become authorized and become legal residents of the United States. So what I do is I refer back to this old provision that goes back to 1929 and say, look, we used to say if you'd gotten here by a certain date and you had behaved in a citizenly fashion and we had, reasonable standards for that, that you were eligible to regularize. And we need to go back to that kind of system because what we have now in the United States is interesting. All this enforcement, it starts just as the undocumented population starts to plateau and then decline, just as unauthorized entries start to decline, just as apprehensions at the border start to decline. And we are in that position now. You would never know it from reading the news. But that's where we are, and we're spending all this money. So we have this population of people in the United States, many of whom have now been here for a long time because we're not constantly renewing with tons of new undocumented immigrants. We need to give them a way to become citizens. So that's one of the policy suggestions I make. I think we need to dismantle what was done in 2003. DHS, ICE, and CBP really, really are dysfunctional. And we need to go back to an organization that is mostly a kind of welcome mat services to help people navigate the process of being in the United States when they weren't born here.
The book is Illegal, How America's Lawless Immigration Regime Threatens Us All. Elizabeth F. Cohen, thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link of that book at majority.fm.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. All right, folks. Interesting stuff.
Immigration is definitely one of my bailiwicks, so it's always interesting to get a new perspective on it. I've tended to approach it more through the lens of labor history, with people like Daniel Denver and Justin Akers Chacon, But the racial stuff is definitely part of it, too. NAFTA played an interesting role, actually, if you'd like to hear about it in brief.
Sure.
So the crackdowns on illegal immigration in the 90s, in the Clinton era, were due to all of the factors that she said, as well as a way to assuage fears that NAFTA would cause a wave of immigration into the U.S. that we were not equipped to handle. At least that's what I got from reading Daniel Denver's book. Some people portray the push for more open borders as part of a neoliberalism, but that's just not true. And I'm talking about open borders for people, not for capital.
What was the fear that there'd be more immigrants here? Because the big fear, as I recall in the time, was the giant sucking sound as all the jobs actually go to Mexico.
Yeah, it's strange, right? Because Janet Reno initially sold NAFTA as a way to decrease immigration. But what NAFTA actually did was it drove people off of their farms and into cities looking for work, and ultimately drove many more illegal border crossings. And you can't have U.S. companies exploiting people in Mexico and places like the Maquila Zone if people are not then trapped in Mexico, right? The immiseration is what drives the immigration. It did not do what they said it was going to do. In fact, it did the exact opposite.
Well, part of it was, too, that you had the U.S. corn 50% cheaper in Mexico than Mexican corn.
Yeah, they flooded the markets with cheap corn. They drove subsistence farmers off of their land. Basically, everything that the Zapatistas predicted was going to happen has come true. Also, a way that criminalization of migration has functioned, I don't know if this is intentional or not, but it's functioned as a way to police labor populations, divide up workers, and keep wages for U.S.-born workers and non-native workers low.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the TA workers who were let go because of the strike, where was this at?
UC Santa Cruz.
I think they were threatened with, like, you know, part of your status being here is contingent on you being employed as a faculty or a TA.
That's a nice little way to control people.
We were watching it happen in real time still.
All right, well, folks, we got to take a break, head into the fun half. Should remind you, the Embark Dog DNA test, it's the key to unlocking your dog's unique breed mix and genetically informed health needs. You want to treat your dog right? You want to know what to feed them? You want to know what diseases to be looking out for? Maybe there's medication that you can take if you are aware that they have a predisposition to a specific disease. Embark DNA test kit. Kelly talks about her testing her dog Edie. Tested clear for all 171 genetic health conditions, so she was super psyched about that. They also look at over, I think it's over 200 breeds, down to like a 5% breed accuracy. So check it out, Embark Dog DNA Test. It is the most comprehensive on the market, and right now Embark has an exclusive offer you cannot get anywhere else. Go to Embark Vet. EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. Save 15% off your dog DNA test kit. Visit EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. When you become a member, you not only get the free half, free of commercials, you also get extra content virtually every single day of the year. Not every single day. Certainly not the weekends. And not every single weekday, but I'd say 98%. And we should really actually run the numbers on something like that. But go to jointhemajorityreport.com, sign up. Join us tonight for our live debate coverage. This is something that what we'll do is we'll probably, like, the live debate coverage, we will now, we'll shoot it on video, and then we'll upload it for members. And you'll be able to watch it in the app. Damn. Right? We've got other members' benefits coming shortly, too, en route via that app. Don't forget, check out TMBS, which was last night, not tonight. Michael Brooks show because of the debate. They did it last night. Who was on that show? Do you remember, Matt? You were here, right?
Yeah, Ben Dixon and Richard Wolff. Richard Wolff was in studio. So we talked about Ben Dixon, about his ongoing campaign against Michael Bloomberg, and talked to Richard Wolff about Marxism and socialism and the labor theory of value.
Dude's the Bloomberg slayer.
Very cool.
He is. I mean, Ben Dixon really... I mean, how much money do you think Bloomberg would have to spend to undo the damage just done by Ben Dixon's Twitter account?
No kidding, right? And Ben could have probably just gone to Bloomberg and said, hey, dude.
He would never, though.
No, that's the thing I like about Ben. Well, there's other things I like about him, too. It wasn't specifically like I met him and I'm like, you're the type of guy who would never sell out to Michael Bloomberg. Folks, also, check out Nomiki Kant's new show, The Nomiki Show. When I don't have to say her last name, I can say her first name, right? Somebody keeps dogging me on Twitter about it. The Nomiki Show. And also, if you're in L.A. and we're trying to work out a simulcast situation, but she is doing a show in L.A. for Super Tuesday. And so if you're in L.A., check that out. If you go, I think, to her Twitter feed, maybe there's a URL for it, but she's going to be here tonight, so she'll tell us then. But she's doing a live show in L.A. David Dayan's going to be on it. Michael Brooks, apparently, is headed out there to do that show.
Doing live shows, wow.
Yeah.
Live shows are the thing now.
Yeah, I guess. I guess for the kids. The oldies don't do that, though. Sometimes. We'll do one. We'll do a live show. We got one coming up on Election Day, folks. And you know what? The rookies do like an hour live show or a 2 hour live show or a 3 hour live show or a 4 hour live show.
Plus
let me
VIP
tell you what
part,
the let me tell you what the pros do. They do a 12 hour live show. Yeah. Yeah. On Election Day, which is also our 10 year anniversary. But we don't need to get into that. So check out the Nomiki Show on Patreon.com. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, I speak with Faye Eckler, vice president and founding member of the Socialist Rifle Association, about gun control, mutual aid, community defense, and why it's a good idea to have an armed left. Now, I will admit to being kind of conflicted about gun control myself. I'm still not totally sure what the correct socialist position is on gun control, but Faye made some very convincing arguments in favor of responsible gun ownership and having an armed left in a country that is already awash in guns and has an armed right. So food for thought, things to chew on. Check it out, patreon.com/theantifada.
This is Michael Bloomberg is defending going Scott Brown over Warren because of Scott Brown's gun control bipartisanship. So
wait, what's that?
Michael Bloom, there's new talking points from the Bloomberg campaign because he supported Scott Brown over Warren, and Bloomberg saying he did that because of reciprocity on some gun control stuff or something. So
He's claiming that Scott Brown was gonna do
was a gun control bipartisan guy, so that's why he supported him over Warren,
right? Which makes all the sense in the world, because we know that Scott Brown was a vote against the Republican Party. Incidentally, folks, Scott Brown was the would have been the Elizabeth Warren would have been the 60th vote in the I'm thinking of Coakley, his race against Coakley. When you vote for a Republican, and this is what, you know, Bloomberg is going to have to address when it comes to why he gave $4 million to Toomey in Pennsylvania. Never mind the money he gave to Rick Snyder, who poisoned all those folks in Flint, Michigan, and more. But when you support, and I don't care if it's Michael Bloomberg or, I don't know, Emily's List or whomever. I think Emily's List may have supported Collins in the past. I'm not sure about that. Sometimes they make some choices that I think are very bad. When you support a Republican, particularly in the Senate, you give power to the Republican Party. It doesn't matter what that individual does, because the Republican Party is going to protect the NRA. So when Mike Bloomberg says that, what he's saying is, I'm not going to say that. What he's saying is, hi, here's a bag of crap that I'm selling you that is actually a bag of gold. I was going to say something about him doing something horrible in his mouth or something. I don't know why. I'm a little bit agitated. So here it is. Jack Pfeffer. There's been a question floating as to why Mike Bloomberg supported Scott Brown in a Senate race over Elizabeth Warren. Response: Mike Bloomberg supported Scott Brown in Massachusetts for many reasons. One of the biggest being Scott's willingness to buck the NRA.
Well, let's hear some of the others, too, maybe.
And his party, yeah, to oppose concealed carry reciprocity that would have allowed people with gun permits in other states to carry hidden handguns in New York City. Mike Bloomberg... Scott Brown's opposition to that was irrelevant. Bloomberg has continued to fight for say, yeah. Okay. In other words, open wide. I'm going to shovel it in. Sorry.
I'm pissed out my leg.
Yeah, good point. All right. Did you want to say something, Matt?
Oh, yeah. Check out Literary Hangover, folks.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
Exactly. Where I don't tell you, where I don't piss down your back.
That's right. That's one of the best things about that show. You can listen to it and nobody pisses on your back.
Don't even piss down your front.
Nope. Folks, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.